Changers.
Hi, and welcome back to Game Changers, powered by Data AI. I'm Chris Uglietta, and today I'm excited to present a podcast I recorded with Shelby Molodina from Double Loop Games. She's the co-founder and game director and COO. She has a rich background from production to engineering to product, and Shelby really is a unique combination of skills. Not only is she very smart on the product quantitative side, but also on the game design, kind of softer creative side as well. She's an artist. So that's kind of a rare combination of, you know, left and right brain, engineering and art, but as well is kind of widely known as one of the nicest people in mobile and just a great team player and leader. So today I was excited to talk to her about her background in gaming, her journey as a woman in this, you know, male-dominated industry, and founding her studio and their progress with their cross-genre game. So we hit a lot of topics. Pleased to present this. Hope you enjoy. Please reach out as usual for any feedback or if you'd like to participate in Game Changers. Thanks for joining. Okay, Shelby, thank you for joining today on Game Changers powered by data.ai. Thanks for coming. I'll admit to the audience here that we're kind of fast friends. We met over being on the same panel at South by Southwest and appreciate the invitation there. And then ran into each other at GDC and just really, I know I've been looking forward to having this conversation with you for our audience.
Yeah, me too. Our panel was so fun that I was really excited to just keep chatting.
Yeah, definitely. And much beyond this as well. So you have a really interesting background, and I was wondering if you could kind of walk through it. You know, I think you're one of the more rare, you know, total utility players in terms of product and design, and you know, tell us and beyond that. So tell us about that a little bit.
Well, I always loved games. Like even back when I was a kid living out in the country in Oregon, and I didn't realize that other girls weren't playing games. And I always played. We had a computer at home from when I was 3 years old in the early 80s. So I was exposed to it. And then at some point I started playing games like King's Quest VI and The Secret of Monkey Island that were so beautiful and they had these amazing stories. And it just like stunned me how amazing they were. And I was like, I need to do this. I need to make games. And I didn't know how to do that. So there was no internet. There was no like figuring out what are the jobs in games and all that. So I just kind of thought about it. I do art. I write. I thought, what am I going to do? What's going to be the best way in? Eventually I decided to get a computer science degree. I felt like that was the most like concrete way to kind of break in. So I was able to do that at the University of Oregon. And it's just always for me been kind of this like singular focus to make games, although I didn't know even really what the roles were or what that really meant. So I've always kind of jumped in and grabbed whatever I can. So I started in QA. I became a gameplay programmer and level designer. That was amazing. They kind of just gave me, they were like, just design all these levels for Rampage Total Destruction, go. And I was like, okay. So I did that and figured it out. And I eventually started organizing the people around me and became a producer. And I went down that path for quite many years, moving through and being a producer and executive producer.
The true heroes of the industry, for sure.
Yeah. It was like trial by fire. But I guess the theme for me has always been that I love to learn new things and grab whatever needs to be done. And as a producer, you really can do that. So having a programming background and design background, I was able to have a sense of how things were really built and what was realistic. I haven't written code now in at least 10 years, but having the background helped me. I just kind of kept doing that. You know, I've worked on a bunch of different genres of games, almost every platform, moved to mobile, became a director of product at DNA. I moved into a central product management and monetization role at Warner Brothers. Sorry, my dog. I'm going to pick him up.
Yeah, classic work from home. Let's do it.
Yeah, there he is.
Beauty.
This is Starbuck. At Warner Brothers, I was able to work with all of the studios, mobile and console, on their live operations plans and how to kind of design core gameplay that works with long-term live ops and free-to-play design. I got to help the console studio start to plan their live operations plans for even non-free-to-play games. And that was a lot of fun, like working with Monolith on Shadow of War and some other things. And then at that point I had kind of really worked in most parts of the game development business side.
These were some pretty big names in the industry.
So I started at Pipeworks Software, which is maybe less known, but then I was at Roblox for a little while. I moved to DNA West, which is a Japanese free-to-play mobile company, which I kind of consider it to be my free-to-play mobile boot camp, because when I was there, we launched 30 games in 30 weeks, which was crazy. I wasn't managing all of them. I was managing about five, but I was in the data and in all the discussions about them, and just learned so much about what was working, what was not working to support a game that needs to be live for many years. The difference between a game that's fun for a week and a game that's fun for 5 years, 10 years. And that was amazing. I learned about how they run really efficient, successful, pretty hardcore live operations. So a lot of my career has been focused, since I moved over to mobile, free-to-play mobile about 6 years ago, I've been focused a lot on more mid-core games, like CCGs, like character collectible games of Injustice 2, a bunch of games at DNA, worked a little bit on DC Legends at Warner Brothers. And that's been really a great and enjoyable time. And then that's kind of all led up to what we're doing at Double Loop Games.
Yeah, I look forward to talking about Double Loop and the story there, but kind of want to hear more about you kind of personally and your journey first, if that's cool.
Yeah, of course.
And so you were in San Francisco, now you're in Portland. I suppose you're working from home, so we can't really talk about, you know, the difference in sort of culture there, perhaps.
I mean, maybe not the difference in office culture between San Francisco and Portland, although I am from Oregon originally, so this isn't super weird. I lived in Oregon, moved to Seattle, lived in Oregon, and then moved down to San Francisco about 8 years ago. And that's where I worked at Roblox and DNA and Warner Brothers and started Double Loop Games. The difference, I would say there's a bigger difference for me, that the switch from working in the office 4 or 5 days a week to working remotely full time. And that was something we had always planned to do at Double Loop Games, to hire people remotely, but have the core team in San Francisco. We did that. And then when COVID happened, it sort of just accelerated our plans. And my family, we moved up to Oregon, you know, temporarily to get more space, because we were, you know, us and three kids in a condo in the Mission in San Francisco.
Oh boy.
Our daughter was doing school, remote school, in the bathroom, because that was the only place that had a door to close. I was losing my mind. So, and I had about 1,000 pages of feature specs to write that summer. And I was like, I can't do this. So we went to Oregon temporarily, and my family's there, and it was really nice. We started looking around at Portland and started just, we found this, you know, we had looked at hundreds of houses in the Bay Area, and we went on a spree in Portland, looked around, and we found the house, you know, the one, the day, the first day.
The one with the appropriate working space.
Yeah. Yeah. So we have, exactly. So everyone, we're basically prepared now to do COVID forever if we had to. Like, our kids can do school. Our toddler basically has a room that can be like a little tiny preschool. My husband has his own totally soundproof office. I have my office that's mostly soundproof. And my requirement was, I didn't want to hear anybody else in the house. Like, I didn't want to hear a toddler or people talking to me. And on the other hand, I do really love going out and seeing my family, like, at a coffee break. I felt like during COVID, I didn't miss like the 2 years of my toddler's little kind of babyhood. I was with them, and I wasn't just away for 9 or 10 hours. So that was really amazing. I do really miss being in the office, though. I've gone up and down about that. It's, of course, like, less stressful to be at home, and we get a lot of work done. We're very successful that way. But whenever I'm back and around people, it's so fun. And it's also just really supercharges the discussions we have after we're in person. So we've really, like, tried to incorporate this, like, model.
Yeah, I mean, right now, as we talked about before this recording, our biggest foes working from home are leaf blowers.
Right.
You know, leaf blowers and Zoom don't mix.
Yes.
And so, yeah, it was so delightful to to meet you and a whole lot of other people at these conferences. And it just reminds me of how important it is to get face to face. I'll be heading over to London pretty shortly to meet with my team. And so I'd love to talk about your approach to mobile and how do you dovetail that at Doubled Loop with, I'm sure you're all fully remote now.
Yeah.
And I know we talked about some pretty cool things you do to kind of keep the team flowing.
Yeah, it's been really an organic discovery of what works for us. So we were all, you know, forced to be remote for a long time. And then, but we missed being together in the office. And there were some things that Emily and I needed to do that we really needed to meet face to face. So in the summer, last summer, I guess that would be 2021, we started dabbling. So Emily came up and stayed with me at my house in Portland. And we were just as COVID safe as we could be, you know, testing, testing all the things. So she came here for a week and it was like, that was great. Then we brought four of the designers up here again and we did a working space. We worked outside in the summer, you know, again, as COVID safe as we could. We were very cautious.
Only in Portland can you do that.
Yeah, in the summer, right. I mean, they'll tell you that it was like 100 degrees. It wasn't actually great. But we did it. It was a lot of fun. So we really bonded and the team was just very different after we did that. We saw the difference of like now people had... Because when the pandemic started, we were four people and we're about 20 now. So four of us had bonded in person, but the other people, we've been doing as much bonding on Zoom and Slack as we can. But in person, you know, suddenly we had all these inside jokes.
Ask you a question? Did you find a way to actually bond on Zoom or how are you bonding on Slack? Because
yeah,
like we've done some live game show type stuff and it's about as cringy and painful for me as an escape room is in real life.
Like, oh my gosh.
And maybe you enjoy escape rooms, so I'm sorry for that.
I've actually never done one. I feel like I'm a little too claustrophobic for it.
Yeah.
But no, it's true. I mean, okay, so first of all, one of the reasons I love being in games is that the people are generally just like really silly and fun, like as a baseline. So our culture, you know, everybody in our company is super smart and talented, but I also enjoy like hanging out with them. So there's a couple things. I mean, we have a culture where we don't consider it a waste of time at all to spend the first 5 or last 5 minutes of our stand-up just like talking about stupid, random, silly things. And people do that. And some people are quieter and some people talk more. So that's always fun. And we never kind of like get back to work. You know, we think that's really valuable. We do have those kinds of like formal things you're talking about where we do this thing called Donut, where everyone's sort of matched with somebody else once in a while to do like a 30-minute just chat, play a game online or whatever. We do Friday happy hours every other Friday that are optional. But I think it's so funny a lot of the bonding really is in Slack. I'm not joking about that. We have this like extremely developed emoji culture around Slack. It's like we have so many custom emojis and some of it's silly and some of it's process. And that's just really organically developed like over the years. So it's like one of our producers' name is William Shook. We have several custom emojis about William Shook, but one of them is like these eyeballs that shake. And so, you know, that one comes out a lot. When we triage feedback on the game internally, our producers literally use the green checkmark emoji to say, I have looked at this one. And then there's a thread for what all the triage steps are under it. So you can just see if things have been followed up on. And at the beginning, we felt like we needed to be like, yes, I have approved this. But now we're seriously like thumbs up. And that's like the official approval.
It sounds a lot like kind of a Twitch Discord community. I'm a huge Twitch fan. And,
oh, nice. Yeah.
You know, it's nice to see those cultures develop organically.
It is. I mean, it's been a lot of fun. And I feel like we also have a really, really deep Zoom background culture. So I'm sure this is more common, but you know, people have their back, like very quiet people will sometimes have like backgrounds set up to say something like funny, like yes or no, like when they don't want to actually say anything verbally. We do these like crazy Photoshopped birthday backgrounds that are surprise, but we set them all up for the person's birthday and everyone has this like crazy background every time. And it's one of those things that I started when we were four people. I made a bizarre, weird one for our art director because his birthday was right after COVID started. And then it's become a thing. And now it's like kind of officially we do it for everybody every birthday and, you know, stuff like that. It's a lot of fun, but we're just kind of silly and enjoy each other. So that helps.
Yeah. When folks saw we were on the panel together, people who knew you reached out and said, you know, Shelby is just one of the most thoughtful people to work with. And, you know, and beyond the kind of the warmth of your love for pink, you know, I can see it kind of shines through in your, you know, approach to the team.
Thank you. That's really kind.
So yeah, you guys are dealing with kind of remote work by getting together periodically for sort of strike team meetings and sort of an Airbnb type atmosphere.
Yeah. So like I was kind of saying, it sort of started organically. Like, here's a thing we all want to do. So there was one, either it's a strike team, like there's a topic. So a couple, maybe a month ago, we had about a week's worth of data we wanted to do a deep dive on. And we said, okay, we're going to bring together Emily, my co-founder and our CEO, our executive producer, our lead designer, and me. And we pretty short notice flew to San Francisco and worked in Emily's apartment for a couple of days doing deep dive of the data. And that's the kind of thing where if we're on Zoom, we'll schedule an hour and everyone gets exhausted. Whereas like in person, Emily had lots of dashboards. We talked through them. We had more of like a free flowing discussion. We discovered more ways to collaborate and tackle it than we ever would have on Zoom, where you're kind of like one person can talk at a time. It was just, so that's the kind of thing that we do whenever we need to. We just say, okay, everyone, let's get together, whoever can. We always approach it as an optional thing too, especially because of COVID. It's always been like, we're going to do this. You are welcome to come. We would love to have you there, but it's not required. Something. And then what we've done really regularly has been about once every 1 or 2 months, we will get an Airbnb either in, and this is the most effective and like best thing we do. We get an Airbnb either in usually Los Angeles or San Francisco, depending, because we have kind of, that's kind of where our centers of gravity are. And we'll bring part of the team that's going to work on specific topics together. And like I said, it's optional, but we decided early on that the Airbnb thing felt a little safer to us COVID-wise than hotels. Now, you know, at this point, I think we're more comfortable with lots of things like hotels, but that's how it started. And we found it was so nice to have our own, since we don't have an office, we don't have a big in-person office, like this Airbnb for like 4 days is a place where people can, a few people can stay, other people can come and work. We work in the living room, we work in the backyard. We and it's been kind of an adventure to like see what all the different houses are. And everyone still talks very fondly about Berkeley House. Like the one we had in November was crazy. There were 43 mirrors in the house. Like people counted it, like, it's just, it's always an adventure, you know? So people, we have dinner together and we, you know, stay up late playing board games and things like that and get work done and discover work and bond. And it's just been really good. So that was all ad hoc. And now we're kind of just now starting to sort of officially say, all right, let's like really make sure we do this once a month with whoever's available, rather than it just being kind of like kind of as needed. So we're kind of moving to that more regular model and I love it. We also now do have a 1 day a week office in Oakland for the team in San Francisco who wants to go. And it's also optional. They get to meet up. It's another game company that they don't use their office on Friday. So we're subletting a conference space like 1 day. So it's a place people, we have about 10 people in the Bay Area. So those people can go and work in person 1 day a week if they want to. But for the rest of us, these kind of monthly get-togethers are a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's a really refreshing model. And it also kind of speaks to testament to your team, you know, the cohabitating for events like that's a pretty big deal. So
yeah, it is. It's a weird thing. I think at most we've had maybe 4 people stay at the Airbnb and we make sure, you know, the houses we have, we make sure that there's like, everyone's got their own space and it's not
okay,
like,
no bunk beds.
No, like there totally was a bunk bed and like a kid race bed that we told our CTO we needed.
Oh, I would grab that in a second.
I know. It was like really the prize. I know you would totally.
Right.
Yeah. I'll send you the link to that house. It was great. There's a pool, there's a race bed. You'll be happy. So, you know, we try to make sure everyone has their space. Certain people might decide to bring their spouses and then they stay at a hotel because they want to do that. So it's pretty flexible. And it's really about like, if we're meeting in Berkeley, for example, only 4 or 5 of us need to stay at the house because there are 10 other people who live in their own places anyway. So they come and they meet with us and then they go back to their own houses. So It's really just kind of been about this, like, more what we felt was more of a COVID safe way to stay. But now we love it.
Yeah, it's the first time I've heard of this model and kind of discussed it with some other folks. And I've heard of companies funding, you know, just pairs, you know, two folks from a team want to get together. Sure, we're going to fund you to, you know, to go meet up in LA or whatever it is. I think it's really, this kind of hybrid model is really, I see the value.
It's awesome. We do the same where we're just like, you know, anytime anyone feels there's value and go and get together, like these two people or four people, like we are very supportive of that for sure. It's so valuable always.
Okay. So changing topics, I want to kind of seize the opportunity, you know, to speak to you as a woman and a successful woman in an industry, you know, frankly dominated by males, especially on the PM and engineering side. And, you know, I have a son and daughter. My daughter is 8 years old, loves games. She's going to be doing her first coding camp this summer. And I'm excited to listen to this podcast with her. And I just wanted to hear kind of your take, you know, sort of just pass the mic to you, you know, talk about your experience or, you know, from any perspective as it relates to this, and then talk about co-founding your studio with another female co-founder and sort of, you know, the story there.
Yeah. So I've been in games just over 20 years at this point. And so there are a lot of things I could talk about when you bring up this topic. I would say that overall, my experiences have been really good. Overall, I've had a lot of really supportive mentors and, you know, whether they were men or women, it's been mostly a very good experience. My first games job, I was hired into a studio, Pipeworks, which was, I was like the 24th person and I was the only woman on the game development team. We had a female admin and that was it. It was me and 24 guys. To me, that's kind of normal because my computer science department was like that. Like I kind of always think of myself as everyone's like big sister kind of, I don't feel like a mom. I sort of feel like I was organizing them, but like they were my friends. It was a lot of fun. I was pretty used to it. A lot of times I don't notice when I'm the only woman in a room, but as the company grew and it got to be about 60 people, I did start to feel insecure about things. Like things would come up or I would be sort of talked over or just a lot of things. And I started to sort of lose confidence in myself and felt like maybe I just suck at this or whatever. But what helped me, I went to my first GDC in maybe 2000. I need to look it up. It was like 2006 maybe. And I went to a couple of women in games roundtables and I didn't speak. I was very like quiet and scared and like, oh, I'm a new person. I don't know. But listening to the women talking, what I got out of it was that I realized there's so many aspects and challenges you face as a minority, a representative of a minority group in any group. So if you are the only woman in a group, then there's a whole bunch of pressure that ends up happening about like representing all women, even if it's not overt. It's like anything you say sort of is sort of evaluated in those terms. And so, you know, as you start looking at it, it's actually a really concrete reason for diversity. It's not just a, that would be good, like check the box sort of thing. It's the more people and the more diverse your team is, the more comfortable people are contributing. And I've found that working with people and talking with people, this is the reason I love games, working with people. The creative process is so much more fun and better than working in a silo by yourself for me. And so the more diverse and comfortable and included your team is, the stronger everybody is, because you get all these weird pressures when you're kind of the only one of any group. So that was tough, but that sort of validated that. And I started to sort of individually push back, and I'm a lot more, now I'll kind of just say what I need to say, but this is like, you know, 20 years ago, I was like pretty new and less secure in my role and all those things. So it was pretty scary. And I started to have conversations like, hey, so in that meeting we just had, I felt like, you know, you interrupted me and it was hard to, and they were pretty receptive to it. I like, to their credit, like it was awkward and difficult, but it got somewhere and it got better. And I developed my own confidence and kind of just realizing like, hey, like I don't actually suck. This is just kind of a challenge of this. And when I moved to San Francisco, Roblox was very male dominated, but actually DNA was almost half women. And it was an incredible studio. They had they had just incredible diversity on engineering, every role. It wasn't just like, oh, there are a bunch of women, you know, stereotypically in marketing or whatever. It was like all roles. I made my best friend there, Sarah Fuchs Downey. She was an amazing executive producer. She's gone on to do things like she was the GM on Covet up until they sold to EA. And, you know, it's just like, it was kind of transformative for me to like have an actually diverse and amazing team to just be like, yep, we are all people and we are all working together. And it was amazing. Warner Brothers also had some women, but it also is a 50-year-old company where the executive leadership is very supportive, but not super diverse, mm-hmm. even if the team on the ground is a little more diverse. So that can create some challenges or not obvious paths to advancement. That's a really important thing for careers for everyone is you need to be able to picture yourself in a role that's out there. You need a mentor. You need it to look possible. Not always, but a lot of times that helps. So if you don't see anybody who is anything like you in this role, you sometimes will just discount yourself and not see a path to it. And
that's the glass ceiling, right?
It's part of it. There's the glass ceiling is also about, I think, the ways that people are traditionally evaluated on characteristics that are stereotypically associated with masculinity and things that are, ways of speaking, aggression. This is all, you know, of course there are nuances and it's never the same like person to person, but kind of in aggregate, the way a man may be evaluated for interrupting or being aggressive or pushy, if you put it in those terms, words, they would be evaluated as being like a great leader and strong and visionary. And unfortunately, a lot of times when a woman has those same kinds of characteristics, they are described in terms more of emotions. So like those words like pushy or emotional or bossy, like all of those things. And there's I also consider that to be a huge part of the glass ceiling, not just the lack of a path or mentorship, but just that we spend so much time, honestly, thinking about everything we say or do in terms of, is this too soft and not going to get me this far? Is it too harsh and it's going to be seen this way? And now I don't think about it as much, well, especially my role now, but I think about it less, but I can't say that ever went away in my 20 years of working at all these companies. It's kind of always like, how is this going to be seen? I literally got a performance review once early in my career that said that I was too friendly. And so, I mean, you might not be like surprised by this since you know me, but like, I was in my 20s and I was like, uh-oh. I mean, this is a company, you know, of all men. And I was like, what are they thinking? What do they think? What does that mean? And it like knocked, I mean, listen, 20 years later, I still think about that. And I enjoy those people and respect those people, but I don't think a man would ever get a review like that. Like it's either a throwaway comment or it comes with a bunch of subtext that is not being said. And you're like, what does this mean? And then it just sort of destabilizes you. So, those are just anecdotal things that have happened, but they do all kind of add up to some friction, a lot of friction. And I have to say, I'm very lucky that I haven't had extreme harassment or lack of support. I've been promoted in my career relatively quickly. I've had great support from my bosses, but there are a lot of people who really hit a very hard glass ceiling or they experience harassment, and they leave the industry. And, you know, that all leads to like, and it's not just women, it's really any minority. When you encounter that friction over and over and over, or you don't see a path to where you're going, that's what happens is the beginning of a funnel of people. It's like, if you want to hire a diverse candidate, say you're looking for somebody who's not just a typical engineer, they have to have gotten all the way through the beginning of their career through 10 years of experience to become, say, a senior engineer. And the pressures and friction on a candidate that it doesn't look like a typical candidate is just much more likely to push them out of the industry, and they'll never get to that point. So, growing talent from the beginning, you know, hiring them straight out of school and supporting them and growing them. And we've tried to create it. I know we'll talk about this more later, but at Double Loop, we try to really create a really supportive and inclusive place where talented people can grow and not experience all that kind of just really unnecessary friction. And I think that's the only way to get people into, get more diverse groups at the higher levels, because what happens is they wash out. And to be honest, the reason I'm still here is because I just love games so much. And when I've tried, I had points in my career where I was like, am I burned out on this job or am I burned out on games? And I thought I was burned out on games. And I'd like for a very short period of time, went and did something else. And I was bored out of my mind. I was like, I can't work on software tools. I can't do this. I have to be creative. I have to be like talking to people about gameplay, but then working on scheduling. But then it's mm-hmm. like, it's not all games. It's not all
games. But it's like, I mean, even talking about the industry, there's people that make games and there's gamers. And those are different populations.
Entirely different. Yeah. And so when I say I love games, I do love games. I play games a lot, but I also love the process of making games. And weirdly, you know, I used to do musical theater from when I was little, from like first grade on. And
shocker.
I know. I was like forced my parents in first grade to like take me to an audition to be in the high school musical of My Fair Lady. Like this is, I was like my poor parents. But I forgot what I was saying, but sorry. I don't know. No, it's okay. Well, no, I guess like that has always been for me, that collaborative creative experience is the thing. And it was in theater and it's been at different things in my life. So you marry like the love of games that they are art and they are science and they are always new and something, always something to figure out, plus the collaborative experience. And I just haven't found that anywhere else. And I don't think I can be happy doing anything else. So I kind of like, well, I need to create an environment where I can do this and it's not toxic. And otherwise I would be gone. And that's what happens to a lot of people.
It sounds like you've really, first of all, thank you for sharing, you know, some really personal stuff there. And what I'm kind of gleaning as well is, you know, you've been able to avoid probably the most toxics of environments.
Yeah.
And maybe that's a testament to your ability to read people and sort of choose who you want to invest time with.
That could be. I do feel there's an element of luck. I do think being multidisciplinary and taking on any challenge that comes your way is always good advice I give everybody in the games industry, because that also gives you a lot more options than if you're sort of pigeonholed into one thing. If you've got a broader set of skills and you can speak to more people, and if you aren't saying, I need to work on this exact genre and this exact game, it's more about the process and learning something, then you do have the ability to sort of adjust your role more, even to switch teams within a company. And I've done that many times. Like my role at Pipeworks literally changed from engineer and gameplay programmer and level designer to producer to senior producer. And then I became a director of product. And so that has all been because I grab anything that needs to be done. And so I always advise that, because if you get into a toxic situation, you got to just leave. Like you can't always just hang on. I've done that too, where I stayed in a toxic situation too long and it really affected my mental health. But there are also times where it's like not quite right, but you can adjust what you're doing. Especially at a large company like Warner Brothers, I was able to move from different central roles and then back onto the studio side, and sort of, once you get to, you sort of establish yourself, that's always possible. So the job you apply for is not always the job you end up doing in the longer run. And that's good to know. But I've been lucky as well. I mean, it's nobody's fault if they get into a company they're really excited about and it turns out their manager is really toxic. You know, one person can completely ruin a job. And so that's not always something you can suss out, but you gotta be true to yourself on that.
For sure. And you never know what's happening above that manager. And as the business pressures rise, it really can change the dynamic and everything flows downstream.
Yeah. And I mean, honestly, some of the most toxic situations I've encountered have not been from my bosses at all. They've been from people that maybe I don't even work with directly that have just sort of had an outsized effect on culture.
Sure.
And that is a hard thing to figure out in an interview.
So a little more on people. you have a female co-founder, Emily, who was a co-founder or founder of Kongregate. And I wonder if you could just tell us that matchmaking story. and then, you know, how did you know this was kind of the thing? And when was it time to raise money? And then we'll talk about the product after that.
So that is a bit of a story, which is a lot of fun. I mean, Emily and I have known each other in the industry as industry friends. We never worked together. We've known each other for maybe 8 or 10 years. We're not really sure like what party we first met at, but we kind of gravitated toward each other. You know,
cool.
We'd see each other at parties and we'd be like, hey, let's sit on this couch and chat. And cause I mean, I even though I love people, I also really hate a room of people that I don't know and just going and being
but
like,
in mobile, it's fun. Like there are these parties and you know this people. Is kind of how the industry works. It's very cool.
That's true. So once you get to know people, you start to gravitate towards. So we always did that over years. We're also part of a group of women in games that we have lunches every once in a while. And we would kind of bond over time and start to really see how aligned our values were. So in the spring of 2019, Emily and I had coffee and she was just talking about how she was starting to think about founding her own game studio and what she wanted to do. And at that time I had, I think, an 8-month-old baby and I like had like 3 hours of sleep that night and I was like barely coherent. But I was just thinking about it a lot and I was like, you know, maybe I could do this. I want to do it. I'd always wanted to start my own studio and do the games I want to do, but I didn't want to. The thing that always stopped me from thinking about a startup was that I had no experience with fundraising. And Emily has a lot of experience with fundraising at Kongregate and many other things, of course, but that one kind of sticking point for me. So we sort of explored our potential partnership. We kind of call it, I mean, it literally is co-founder dating. Like we got coffee, we started working like one day a week, sort of unofficially in her living room and talking about our values and our skills and where we had overlaps and differences in our skills and the responsibilities. We talked about audience that we might want to make games for, what might be important to them. So it's kind of top to bottom, just talking and talking and talking for several months, like 3 months. I think it was E3 where she kind of like popped the question. She's like, so do you want to do this? And I was like, yes.
That's a really thoughtful approach. Like to sit down and be like, here's my strengths. Here's my weaknesses. Here's the overlay.
I mean, a lot of credit to Emily on that. I'm very open to that and I love doing it, but she was very intentional. She was talking to many, she was dating around. She was talking to a lot of potential co-founders and, what was important is that to us was have a lot of hard conversations then, because what happens with a lot of startups and co-founders is you're best friends and you go into it and then things get hard and then things get really difficult between you. And if you haven't found ways to work through difficult times, then a lot of times co-founders end up splitting up and just having really toxic situations. So, you know, you can never cover it all in that early phases, but we did have hard conversations. We had disagreements about what we thought we should be making and came to it, you know, worked through it and figured out that we have a similar, you know, we do research on what we're saying. We're not just like emotionally kind of being like, my idea or the highway. It's really about what's the right thing for the game in the studio. We talk, you know, we're respectful of each other's ideas and we like truly admire each other. And we talk all the time about how we have these pretty complementary and separate superpowers, but then there's really nice places where it overlaps. So, you know, I focus more on the game side, top to bottom running. I'm the game director. When we were very small, I did all of the production management, product and game design, worked directly with the engineer and our art director. I review all the art. I don't art direct, but I am very like the vision. I'm the vision holder on it. Emily represents our audience in many ways. Like she's our best play tester and our best kind of person who has kind of a razor for whether something's going to kind of resonate with the audience we're talking about or not. And she has a ton of experience with publishing, fundraising, and also analytics. That's her secret superpower. I mean, she actually has been our data scientist for the last 6 to 8 months, setting up with the engineers, our analytics pipeline. And that's not normally what you'd have your CEO do. She loves it and she's great at it. And we didn't have a data scientist yet. And so it's like, we've both been able to sort of jump in at different unexpected places. And I'll let you go ahead. I know there were other questions you had about like, how did we know when it was time to fundraise?
And yeah. That's interesting. Well, I want to talk about the game. And cause you're deciding to do something pretty bold here, you know, across a couple genres. And, you know, how did that, tell us about that, you know, kind of briefly, what are the mechanics there? Whatever you can share. Pre-release.
So I'll keep it a little bit high level because we're pre-release. So we started from our audience and we're making games for people who don't consider themselves to be gamers, but they do play games. So it's not people who've never picked up a mobile phone before. It's people who maybe they play match threes like Gardenscapes or Royal Match, or maybe they played Draw Something a ton like I did, creativity games. They're playing casino games or solitaire games. They're familiar and they're playing for several hours a day potentially. They don't take on that identity of I am a gamer. Mm-hmm. Like if you ask them if they're a gamer, they'll say no. But then you look and they're like, well, you played this game for 2 hours today.
Right. Maybe they came in through hyper casual and kind of leveled up there.
Yeah, exactly. And they tend to really stick with their games and play, say, Gardenscapes for 7 years. And some characteristics of them as well is that they don't, if you have a kind of gamer identity and you're kind of like, I'm a gamer and I do consider myself to be a gamer, you know, you're more open to a game that maybe you don't understand the mechanics right away and you kind of will fight through it to figure it out a little bit more. You're more likely to. A person who is not considering themselves to be a gamer, they might pick up a game and if it's confusing or looks a little too hardcore, you know, they'll immediately kind of, instead of saying the game is, I'm going to overcome this game, they'll kind of say, oh, this game is not for me. And this is again, like kind of as a generalization, not everybody, but so it's really important in our game to make a game that is not intimidating when they pick it up, that they feel very comfortable, that people are like, hey, this game is for me. And yet we feel that our audience is really underserved as far as really deep and meaningful mechanics around social, some live event gameplay. You know, if you're just playing a puzzle game, it's really challenging to do really meaningful social. You can do leaderboards, you can send each other lives, but you can't really like deeply collaborate on something or, you know, put together in a mid-core game, you'd consider like a raid boss, right? Like you'd be like, everyone, we're going to get together at 7 p.m. and we're going to, you know, you bring this part of the team, I'm going to bring this team, let's buff these up, everyone work, get everything ready, let's go, let's attack the monster at the same time. That is obviously, as a fiction skin, is not going to work for our audience, but those sorts of deep emotions and mechanics are very applicable to this audience. And in many, many types of games, like just a strict puzzle game doesn't really support that as well in a meaningful way. So we looked at, as you mentioned, like a cross-genre hybrid game. So we have a puzzle core which first of all, we spent months prototyping a mechanic that we wanted it to be fresh. We didn't want to go straight into the red ocean of match three. We didn't want to just be a match three. We didn't want to be something they'd seen. We didn't want to necessarily compete exactly in that space. So we wanted it to be something fresh, but also based on my experience, many games where sometimes you make it too fresh and you get like in love with your idea of this like really awesome, amazing new mechanic, it can go too far and be not understandable or widely appealing. So finding that balance is where we spent our time on prototype. So we worked on prototyped our core. We play tested it. We had people play test it. We felt like, okay, this is tunable. This is extensible. This is appealing. It's fresh, but not too weird. So we had to make some judgment calls because it's so early. You can't put it out in soft launch and get data. So we had to use our experience there. Then we expanded it and I had done a design for that. And this is a part I won't get too into detail on, but it hooks into a really meaningful and delightful metagame where there's a lot more. You get things from the puzzle. It unlocks things that you're not just playing a puzzle and then you decorate a garden and then the garden is like done or whatever. It's like, you play the puzzle, you unlock meaningful things that you can do things with, and yet those mechanics are really light and delightful. We focus a lot on really funny little sounds and animations and making everything just really delightful. And if you want, and basically we bring you slowly into this actually very deep game, but
there's like a teaching flow there.
Yeah, there's a teaching flow, you know, start you with small amounts of it. You don't have to do all of it, but what we, our goal and what we're seeing in our players is that people come in for the puzzle core. And then as they start to dabble in the other side of it, they love it and they have time to get comfortable with it. And then players who engage with that side of the game, the meta game side, they have longer sessions, they retain better. And that was always the goal, that this puzzle is sort of a light, big bite-sized, snacky kind of gameplay. And if you love the game and you love the world and you love to, you start to get comfortable interacting with other people, then there, it just like opens up this whole bigger holistic loop that will hopefully be really satisfying and collaborative and enjoyable for 5 or 10 years. And again, it's like striking that balance of it not being too high pressure, not coming off as hardcore, but being a really safe and enjoyable place to have meaningful gameplay.
So this is a bold move. you know, what's the upside, you know, kind of taking the harder road here? Is it UA, you know, being able to target players from, you know, more games or more genres? Is it, are you seeing deeper engagement than you would if it was just a single genre style game?
Yeah. I think UA is something that we said, well, we hope that what we get is, you know, these overlapping audiences, these overlapping genres, we hope that we get the join of those, that we get all of the players from this and all the players from this and they like our game. There's always a risk. Like, that's an area that I think is still, you know, how do we make sure we're getting both and not just like the tiny like overlap of both? And that's not what's playing out, but that was always a risk. So I'd say that one was not a slam dunk, that this was like definitely going to be great in that way. We hoped it would be, and it is working out. The real upsides are in offering something. There's this really large audience of this type of gamer who are playing games, and they're monetizing and not monetizing. There's a ton of revenue out there, large audience share, and it seems really crowded. But when you look at it from the angle we're looking at it, it's, we feel that they're actually underserved and that there is this big gap in the market that we are trying to fill and offer something new. And you know, you can't, if you're a fast follow company, lots of companies do that and they're successful, pump out lots of games that are not so groundbreaking. We know that it's a big risk to do something that isn't exactly what's out there, but the upsides of it are so much greater. If you can make it work, if it sticks, if people enjoy it, you can build an audience around your game that is not just like a subset of the audience of some other game. Mm-hmm. Like, you're not just like a knockoff of game X or whatever. So we hope that the upside is our audience is the join of these two audiences, a much larger addressable audience than either, that we can bring them in. And as I was kind of mentioning earlier, one of the big goals through the social collaborative gameplay that's meaningful and not just like send a gift, don't get a gift, it's like actually collaborative, is that you see that that does lead to greater engagement and retention and monetization. And that what we're hoping is to create this game that people are playing for 5 or 10 years as a hobby, and that it's meaningful to them in their lives, and that it's not a game that people play for a month and drop. So the upside for us on that is, you know, we can focus and polish and kind of master this game and grow it over time. And that is a much better strategy for us to, it's kind of the supercell model. Is if you think of another company that we're most aspiring to be like, it's more like supercell than other company than some other options, where we focus on really high quality games that are going to be big hits, and we really focus on them and we polish them and we launch. This is the idea. You know, we launch, we grow that. We don't just abandon it. We start the next one. We're growing that and not abandoning it. And so mm-hmm. over time, you build this portfolio of really long running, strong games, not a portfolio of a bunch of like scattershot sort of shotgun approach stuff. And so we're trying to carve out our own space and identity in the market. And it is risky, but the upside is huge, we hope.
Of course. Thanks for sharing your story. I'd love to circle back and kind of talk another time about, you know, soft launching and launching. And when do you think you'll be in that phase?
That's not something I can't give you a date. we're doing limited releases and tests now. And what we do it, I sort of alluded to this earlier, we're very methodical about what is the goal of this prototype or this release. And we have criteria that we pass, fail. We are prepared to hard pivot. We've been prepared to hard pivot and totally change our game if we had to. We were trying to be honest with ourselves. We didn't have to. We've learned a lot. It's gone really well. So we're still in a phase of, okay, we are testing this piece. Well, it's a tech test. We're testing this piece, which is early retention. We're focusing on that. And because we're not a game, I worked on a lot of licensed IP where you're a game that is like has to be day and date with a show or a movie. We don't have that. We, of course, do have money, time, scope, all those things are still real. But the date that's the right date for the game has to do with how are we moving through these gates and do we need to pivot? Do we need to focus? Do we keep going and being honest with ourselves about those gates? So we are approaching it from a true, as we get there into a true soft launch approach where it could be 6 months, it could be a year, it could be, and the outcomes are, we have plans A, B, C, D, E, F, G for all the ways to manage the game in our company and our runway and all of the things.
I love that answer. I mean, it sounds like you really plan to allow yourself runway, you know, set up for success and not kind of put yourself, you know, back against the wall having to, you know, to hit a season or something for a launch.
That is very true. You know, going into it, we wanted to make sure that we had runway to make two or three games because it's very rare that a team's very first game is a massive hit. And we are seeing really good signs from our game and we believe in it a lot, but we also are really conservative. We don't want to overhire and spend all our money. And like you said, back against the wall, if you're running out of money, that is the worst time to fundraise. And so of course that happens to the best of us. We could make two games, three games and none of them be a hit. And I don't have a guarantee that wouldn't happen, but we have really tried to set ourselves up pretty conservatively for success there.
Shelby, if folks want to reach out and find you on the internet, what's the best way to do that?
I am on Twitter. It's at Shelby Maladina. I don't tweet very much, but you can definitely, but since I don't, I will see it. If you tweet me, I will see it. If you DM me, I will see it because I don't do it that much, but I'm going to be on there a little more as we start talking about our game a little more.
Cool. Well, let's keep in touch. I appreciate your time. I think you're going to a team offsite. You're flying out this afternoon, so enjoy that.
Yeah, going down to San Francisco for 2 days. We're doing like a little strike team on a couple of topics. So yeah, it'd be great.
Good. Well, I appreciate you making the time here on Game Changers.